They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
One wishes the markets would make up their mind. Is the European debt deal a good thing or a bad thing? We'll have today's version of events. Also, our series Food for 9 Billion continues from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 12th of December, and I'm going to bet you $10,000 you can't guess where we're going to start today. Nah, it's a sucker's bet. Really, it's Europe. You knew that. But here's the thing. The big political disagreements we've been having here over the economy and what to do about it, whether to cut spending or spend more and hope there's growth, they're doing the same thing over there. Austerity on the one hand or stimulus on the other. From Washington, Marketplace's David Gura starts us off on the Europe story today.
A new treaty would require countries to balance budgets by slashing spending and raising taxes. They'd have to keep their deficits down or pay penalties.
These would be legally binding strictures on members of that fiscal union.
Dan Hamilton heads the Center for Transatlantic Relations at Johns Hopkins. The theory is balanced budgets and smaller deficits boost confidence. That would encourage investors to, say, buy European bonds.
If you can get confidence in your economy and a basic stability to the economy through the entire pan-European market, that confidence would allow economies to grow.
A pan-European market, Hamilton reminds us, that's made up of 500 million people. But critics say these restrictions would hurt countries like Italy and Greece. Ralph Bryant is with the Brookings Institution.
Well, I don't think you'll grow your way out with very harsh austerity.
At least in the short term. Bryant says, sure, balanced budgets are good in the long run, but maybe they shouldn't be the top priority when economies are in trouble, like they are in Europe and in the U.S.
It's a more severe trade-off in Europe, I think, than it is here in the United States, but it's qualitatively similar.
And that debate in Europe is one we probably want to pay attention to. Stephen Strand teaches economics at Carleton College. He says how things play out in Europe will ripple across the Atlantic.
We're so interconnected that if they have some sort of a financial freeze, that undoubtedly is going to carry over into the United States.
In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
We ask ourselves around here, not infrequently as it happens, whether we're spending too much time on the Europe story. Is it all that or is it just us? So we went out today and asked around, do you care or don't you?
You know, it's gone to hell. Just like here.
No, concerned about it, but I don't spend a lot of time worrying about it.
If we're going to be part of the European Union, you play by their rules, and if you want to be rescued by them, well, you have to play by their rules.
It's the trickle-down effect. It's going to really hurt us, too.
There's a lot of countries that are going down the pan. I think Britain will be a lot better if they weren't in the Eurozone.
That was Mark Wheaton and Sarah Tinge, both in Portland, Oregon. Roni Nissan out of Madrid, Spain. Stanrod Herskovitz in Cleveland. Terry Wald out of London, England at the end there. And that, as it happens, is where we're going next. Because Britain, as you know, is not in the Eurozone. They still use the pound. And at the moment, it's on the outs with the larger European Union as well. Because last Friday, at the height of all the Sturm und Drang over the EU rescue deal, Prime Minister David Cameron was the lone dissenter. No thanks, he said, to the treaty meant to create a new fiscal union. Too threatening, apparently, to London's financial industry. Our man in London, Stephen Beard, picks it up from there.
With permission, Mr. Speaker, I would like to make a statement on last week's European Council.
In a rowdy House of Commons today, Prime Minister Cameron stoutly defended his actions at last week's European summit in Brussels.
I went to Brussels with one objective, to protect Britain's national interest. And that is what I did.
The Prime Minister wrapped himself in the Union flag. His more ardent supporters say he's the latest in a long line of British heroes valiantly defeating European aggression. Henry V at Agincourt, Wellington at Waterloo, Churchill in the Battle of Britain. His Conservative Member of Parliament, Andrew Rossendale.
He really has shown some bulldog spirit, which I think will be applauded by the vast majority of British people.
Cameron's defiance of Europe has thrilled the general public and has pleased some key figures in London's financial centre, known as the City. Terry Smith runs the Tullett Prebon brokerage. He says by refusing to sign up to the new fiscal union, Cameron has saved London from a fresh new wave of tax and regulation.
There's certainly plans afoot in Europe to tax financial transactions and to regulate the markets that operate in the City, which it may now avoid.
But not everyone is applauding Cameron's staunch defence of Britain's financial sector.
It leaves us utterly marginalised, utterly isolated.
I don't think that's good for jobs in the City or elsewhere. I don't think it's good for growth.
Lord Oakeshott and Nick Clegg of the Liberal Democrat Party, which is sharing government with David Cameron's Conservatives. They're deeply upset about Cameron's move. Vince Cable, another Liberal Democrat who's the business secretary, says the finance industry is not synonymous with the UK's national interests.
Most of our problems in the UK were centred on the banking sector, which frankly did grow disproportionately large for the UK economy. It was balance sheets four times our GDP, one of the largest in the world, and that was a problem.
And yet, Cameron's critics say this bloated industry with its huge bonuses is now being favoured at the expense of Britain's relations and its trade with its European partners. Liberal Democrat Lord Oakeshott says Cameron has backed the wrong horse.
I believe the EU and the Eurozone will now get their act together and will move forward. And we will, frankly, just be at the back of the train, not consulted.
But the mayor of London, who supports Cameron's move, has scoffed at the idea the EU is getting its act together. He's called the new pact the Supranational and Fiscal Union, or SNAFU for short. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Technology and Europe, the strange economic bedfellows of the day on Wall Street. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. An interesting thing happened on the way to the end of the United Nations climate conference this weekend. Didn't wrap up when it was supposed to. Delegates hung around long enough to hammer out an agreement on a roadmap for a process to reach a deal. In other words, things kind of got done. So we got one of our sustainability gang, Scott Tong, on the phone this morning to explain what it means. Point one, he said, is that China and India have finally signed on, which changes the whole ballgame.
For the longest time, enshrined in this process was this adult table and the kids table, right? And the rich countries had these regulations and these strict caps, and the poor countries said, well, you know, we're not in it. We're not the historical emitters. So, you know, we'll just kind of watch and maybe we'll do something. Well, now that we've moved on from that. Everybody is in now. And that was a big thing that the United States always had an issue with. And now, to the extent that there is a victory, I guess, for the U.S. position, China, India, Brazil, they're all in now.
Specifically not in the deal, though, Scott said, are any new limits on greenhouse gas emissions, reducing the amount of carbon in the atmosphere. And if you remember, that had been the whole idea of the big climate meeting in Copenhagen a couple of years ago. So,
if you are the energy experts who are counting this, we're getting closer and closer to locking in a 2 degrees Celsius temperature increase. And that's important because that is the point when bad things start to happen, and they're pretty sure they will. And we're about 80% there now.
There was also, Scott said, an agreement to extend in principle the current International Treaty on Climate Change, the Kyoto Protocol, it's called. But this afternoon, Canada pulled out of that treaty. It can't work, the Canadians said. Word is that Zynga, the online gaming phenomenon, is going to go public this week. When it comes to IPOs, you never know until you almost really know. But Wall Street seems to think the stock offering could raise more than $1 billion. For those for whom, like yours truly, social gaming doesn't really do it, Zynga is the company behind Farmville and a whole slew of other popular online games. It's also a company that has figured out how to make money by selling virtual stuff, which is kind of amazing. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Zynga's best known for creating social games on Facebook, like Farmville and Mafia Wars, which have attracted more than 200 million users. Now Zynga's branching into mobile games. The thing about Zynga is its games can be addictive.
That's why Alec Baldwin got himself booted off a plane last week. I mean, he didn't want to stop playing Words with Friends on his cell phone.
Michael Pachter is a video game analyst at Wedbush Securities. He says Baldwin may not be the ideal airline passenger, but
it's still a great advertisement for Zynga because I think that a lot of investors don't think that they know anybody who's ever played a Zynga game. And that's just not true. It's people like Alec Baldwin and me.
Zynga's games are free. It makes money by selling virtual goods like make-believe cows on Farmville or bloody chainsaws on Mafia Wars. But only a tiny fraction of hardcore addicts ever spend a dime. This year, Zynga's set to earn more than $40 million in profits, but Wall Street thinks it has serious potential. When the company goes public, it's likely to be valued at $7 to $9 billion.
That's a lot.
Bill Blau is an analyst at Gartner.
I don't know how other ways you can calculate it to say it's not a lot, but it is. There's clearly some hype that's built into this.
And lots of pressure, too. To live up to that stock price, Zynga's going to need a steady string of hits and lots of Alec Baldwins. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
We get, on average, every year, I'd say about a bajillion books in the mail. Some we read and some we do interviews about. Most, just because of the numbers, we don't. So every year we ask some of our regular marketplace voices and a few select others to share their picks for the best business-related books of the year. Here with the 2011 version.
I'm Andrew Ross Sorkin, co-anchor of CNBC's Squawk Box and editor of the New York Times' Deal Book. And I'm the author of Too Big to Fail. My favorite business book of 2011, by a square mile, was Walter Isaacson's Steve Jobs. It was a remarkably revealing biography of the most important businessman in generations. But what made Isaacson's book so compelling was the unvarnished and uncomfortable truths about Jobs' personal tics and life at home. For a man who was a perfectionist about Apple's products, it was an eye-opening lesson to see the often less than perfect moments behind the scenes.
I'm Dan Charnas, the author of The Big Payback, The History of the Business of Hip-Hop. My favorite business book of the year is 18 Minutes by Peter Bregman. 18 Minutes addresses the problem of time for busy professionals. How is it that our days, our weeks, and our years seem to get away from us while the to-dos pile up endlessly?
I'm Gail Zamaak-Lamont, author of The Dressmaker of Karkana. My favorite business book of the year is Poor Economics by Abhijit Banerjee and Esther Duflo. Poor Economics moves beyond all the bluster of development theories crafted in fancy rooms. It actually examines at close range the rational economic decisions made by folks living on less than a dollar a day.
I'm Clay Shirky, and I teach theory and practice of social media at NYU. My favorite business book of 2011 is Reinventing Discovery by Michael Nielsen. It describes the way the sciences are making use of global communications networks, not just to communicate discoveries, but to make them. Scientists studying everything from protein folding to galaxy mapping to deep mathematical puzzles are using all kinds of techniques.
This is Majora Carter, host of APM's The Promised Land. My favorite business book of 2011 is Nothing to Lose, Everything to Gain by Ryan Blair. It's an autobiography of someone who started out as a typical middle-class kid. But when his family's financial situation took a nosedive, he was headed down the same path that many low-income urban youth find themselves on. Gangs, crime, a juvenile record, and very little hope. With the right care and attention, Ryan turned his life around and discovered how street smarts can lead to very successful business smarts.
I'm Liaquat Ahmed, author of the book Lords of Finance, and my favorite book this year was Washington a Life, Ron Chernow's epic portrayal of our first president. When Washington assumed office, the new republic was on the verge of bankruptcy, and his cabinet divided by Hamilton and Jefferson's bitter feuds over economic policy. Nevertheless, Washington, through decisive leadership, restored the credit of the U.S., got the economy out of depression, and endowed the office of the presidency with enormous prestige.
That Chernow book was pretty good. The Jobs book by Isaacson, I liked it. Not my favorite. There's more about each of them and a list of the ones I really did like in the Big Book section of our website, marketplace.org/thebigbook. Coming up, let them eat bread, if they can afford it.
The revolution started because of the price increases. In the old days, nothing like this happened. We used to eat off our land.
Our series, Food for 9 Billion, when we come back. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, the Dow Industrials tumbled 162 points today, 1.3%, settled at 12,021, neatly palindromic there. The NASDAQ ditched 34 points, also about 1.3%, 2612. The number, the S&P 500 down 18 points, 1.5%, finished things at 1236. Bank stocks led the sell-off, don't you know? Shares of Morgan Stanley coughed up more than 6%. Citibank dimmed 5.3%. Bank of America shriveled more than 4.5% today. No joy in Techland either, and that on the birthday of Robert Noyce. Look it up. Chipmaker Intel lowered its revenue projections for the rest of the year. Investors lowered its share price by more than 4%. Hewlett-Packard logged off 1.5%, while Microsoft slumped 0.75%. Drugmaker Pfizer announced it's raising its quarterly dividend by 10%, but no great shakes for investors. Shares fizzled 0.8% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.07%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. Did you do your Christmas shopping early? You're way ahead of me. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for November. The Federal Reserve holds its last scheduled meeting of the year on interest rates and the economy. And a House Transportation and Infrastructure Subcommittee talks about the effectiveness of our nation's public alert system. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media, APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. The second phase of Egyptian elections begins today. Votes by overseas Egyptians are going to be counted. And among the many things ultimately at stake in the first democratic elections there in decades is the price of food. High prices for bread, in particular, helped fuel the protests in Tahrir Square back in January. Experts say that if Egypt is going to have any chance at feeding its 85 million people, it needs a food policy do-over. Our series, Food for 9 Billion, is all about the global challenge of feeding a growing world. And today, the market realities of food independence. Sandy Tolan reports from Cairo.
Egyptians are proud to say that their revolution, swelling up from here in Tahrir Square, was about dignity and shaking off a dictator. But look back 3 years earlier to the international food crisis of 2008, and you'll see more groundwork for the revolution. As global commodity and petroleum prices rose, cooking oil, tomatoes, lentils, rice, and wheat soared out of reach for many families. Riots and protests broke out around the world. In Egypt, fights erupted in bread lines, and some Egyptians died. Few things are more important in Egypt than the price of bread. It's at the center of nearly every meal, like here in the home of Kotab and Saba Orani Saber. They live with their three kids in a single room of a Cairo villa.
The revolution started because of the price increases. In the old days, nothing like this happened. We used to eat off our land. But here and now, everything is expensive.
Kotep didn't used to worry about high prices. As a farmer, he wanted them. His family comes from more than 100 generations who grew Egypt's food in the fertile Nile silt. Now, Kotep is one of more than a million Egyptians who've quit the land. Some estimate the number is closer to 4 million. No longer growing food, his family spends more than half its income on it.
We are unable to save money, so until God makes it easier, we are just taking it step by step.
Until 50 years ago, Egypt's farmers grew all the nation's wheat. Today, the country imports more than half. To understand how this happened, let's get out of Cairo. On a desert road outside of town, a new kind of Egyptian agriculture was born under former President Mubarak.
And I went to look at where the land, the factory, would be built, and it was just pure desert.
25 years ago, Mubarak invited investors to reclaim the desert. One of the first to arrive was Tariq Taufik. He's part of a wealthy merchant class that worked with capital from Egypt and the Gulf to green up the desert with underground water and grow not wheat for Egypt's daily bread, but more profitable grapes and strawberries for Europe.
And then in no time, you know, there was this factory built up, farms set up, 3 or 4 other factories mushroomed out of this factory.
Now, some in Egypt say, why should these guys use our precious water to send luxury fruit to the French? The answer, according to free market economists, is something called comparative advantage. It's a strategy promoted heavily here and around the world by the U.S. Agency for International Development. Grow what you can for domestic consumption and import the rest using cash from these high-value export crops. But this was no free market. The model under Mubarak was distorted, built on favors. And cash never really trickled down.
When we went to the extreme in the process of liberalizing the economy, we brought people who have nothing to do with agriculture.
Egyptian economist Magda Kandil says in the Mubarak era, crony capitalism ruled.
They are entrepreneurs. Some of them live abroad, live in the U.S. They've been capitalizing on connections that the average farmer cannot have in terms of marketing, economy of scale, access to water, access to technology, access to subsidized fuel, access to subsidized fertilizers. So I'm against this model because it doesn't help the social agenda.
Another thing that didn't help? Pushing millions of farmers off the land. How'd that happen? Let's hop on the scooter of a guy named Hussein Abdul Wahab Haiba. He's resplendent in his turban and full-length white robe. Hussein comes from the farming district of Al-Fayoum, a couple of hours south of the desert farms. He's seen 80% of his friends and family leave his village. The causes were many. Families grew too big for a single plot, fertilizer got too expensive, and under Mubarak-era laws, land rents got so high the farmers couldn't afford them anymore. Just as bad, say local farmers, land and water were stolen. Hussein says his father received 2 acres from President Nasser's land reform in the 1950s. But 4 decades later, Mubarak's police state took it away and gave it back to the original landlords.
This is our main source of water, what used to cultivate all our old land from before. Look here, right here in front of you.
Hussein stands next to a large green water wheel, where he says local farmers' historic flow shrunk to a trickle.
This is a whole scheme. This guy was connected with the police force, with the enforcers in the government. It's given to the cronies, to the families, to the well-connected people, to the people who serve their purposes. This is why there was a revolution.
During the Arab Spring, Hussein and his friends traded shifts, heading toward Tahrir in waves of minivans from the farmland in Al-Fayoum, demanding help for farmers wanting to stay on the land and grow food for Egyptians. Had they bumped into Mamdou Hamza, they would have found a kindred spirit. Hamza's a prominent engineer who spent countless days and nights at Tahrir as a kind of godfather of the revolution. Hamza says Egypt is vulnerable to another global food crisis because it doesn't grow enough for its own bread.
But that's the only way you can save the future agriculture of Egypt. Then you can cultivate the crops you need to minimize the gap between what we need and what we produce.
But that won't happen simply by rooting out corruption and making it easier for farmers to stay put. The country will need to modernize, more efficient irrigation, larger land plots through farmer cooperatives, criminalizing land grabs around the fertile delta. Otherwise, he says, the country will be vulnerable to price spikes in the global food supply and to the political agendas of wheat-exporting countries like Russia and the United States.
It could happen. People could use that strategically against us to push us to do things which we should not, would not otherwise like to do.
Making Egypt more self-reliant in food is not exactly the top item on Egypt's political agenda. Not when a new parliament will be fighting simply to implement democracy amidst military control. But from Mexico to Ghana, Bangladesh to the Philippines, citizens' groups and some national leaders link food self-sufficiency with national security. They say the international markets have failed, and it's time to grow more of our own at home. In Cairo, I'm Sandy Tolan for Marketplace.
Our series, Food for 9 Billion, is a collaboration with Homelands Productions, PBS NewsHour, and the Center for Investigative Reporting. You can find earlier episodes on our website. It's marketplace.org. Sandy had help with his reporting today from Charlotte Buchan.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which I lift unashamedly from my colleague John Moe at the Marketplace Tech Report. John noticed some reports in USA Today and elsewhere about colleges and corporations and nonprofits buying up the XXX domain name for their particular institutions. XXX was approved last week as domain names for porn sites, as you may have heard. And Lord knows the marketing people at, you know, GM don't want to be seeing GM.XXX out there, right? The Associated Press says the University of Kansas spent $3,000 for Kansas.XXX. And it's worth a note that Marketplace.XXX has already been taken too by us, lest you get any ideas. It went for $250 for 10 years, which, frankly, I'm a little insulted by. I don't know. All right, that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow tumbled 162 points, 1.3%. That's $25 a year, by the way. That's like nothing. The NASDAQ ditched 34 points, also about 1.3%. The S&P 500 gave back 18 points, 1.5%. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Gina Delvac, Justin Ho, Millie Jefferson, and Fiona Ng. Coming up next time, back here.
Our greatest worry about our future in Napa Valley is that we will look like Vail in 20 years because the growth in this community is at the very top and at the very bottom.
Making wine and a middle class as well. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, that's American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.